Flavorable Beyond Shadow segment. Reconstructions in the terrorist game. Colored bullets. White bullets. Part 2. Now dealing with this issue of how cats like Lamar were orchestrating themselves within the body of politics to help facilitate more violence, only with the veneer of decency, which of course we know is a fraud. You had in October 31st, 1873, the elections in Mississippi, where the black vote was the majority. Ames became the Republican governor. He beat Alcorn by 30,000 votes. That same year, in election, new legislation and black dynamics came to the fore, where of 115 state representatives, 55 were black, and 9 of the 37 senators black. Yet, during the same time, the crushing of Native Aboriginals, Civil War, slavery, were all living memory. Violence, basically, as a way of life and control of black people and black slaves and Native Aboriginals, are deeply rooted in the Southern experience and the American experience. Not just by individuals or posses, but the whole governmental structure. And what I mean by this is, you know, the gun laws that were passed, like the Second Amendment, was really a reality that the slave plantations and slavery was essentially a giant police system, along with the economic enterprise and dynamics and all of that that we know. But it was essentially a police system where you have a police system where regular slave patrols and armed citizens were constantly on display. The armed display and patrols were a show of force and discipline, making sure that black people were not gathering or engaging in unwanted activity, to psychologically overwhelm the slaves with a show of power and with the physical use of violence on them when need be. That made clear that any insurrection would end in a horrible death. White males and female plantation owners had to be involved in slave patrols with their own means of transportation, equipment, and arms. If you were, you know, a wealthy flesh peddler, you can send a, you know, like a white mercenary in your place. In 1779, Virginia's meeting in Richmond was to ratify the U.S. Constitution, as everyone knows. The 8 colonies were ready to be ratified. Virginia was a key focus on this issue, in the home of Pat Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. They were all involved in the slave game. James Madison, who was the main author of the Second Amendment, this is the Gun Amendment, wrote it to give confidence to Southern slave states that Congress wouldn't neutralize the Southern slave states' vehicle of control of the slave population. Neutralize it, meaning they would not disarm the armed slave patrols by the ratification of a new constitutional authority over the militia formation through disarmament, for that was the primary vehicle of control of the slaves collectively in the South. The state militias, basically, is what I'm saying, war slave patrols. In Georgia state statutes, it was required that the patrols under the authority of militias officers each month, they had the authority to check every plantation and search, quote, all Negro houses for offensive weapons and ammunition, unquote. The slave patrols and militias were basically one and the same. Flesh Petler states, slavery control features of life. The white gun and bullet was a primary way of controlling the slaves. And in the post-Civil War Reconstruction era, that white bullet would come to play again. So here is the dynamic that black people once again found themselves in when they were trying to enfranchise themselves and started to ascertain certain rights that were a challenge to white elite authority and dominance. The tool of violence. Became, of course, just as political as the vote itself. And it then thereby became a deciding factor on who could and who could not vote. So the bullet was the lawmaker and a decider. So, another dynamic of a civil war, so to speak, was playing itself out on these racialized grounds. And for black people, especially in the South, everything was once again at stake. Or as I noted, even though the Civil War was about slavery, it was not about black emancipation or liberation. Now, Mississippi's elites, the Bourbons, saw themselves in the same light, as I mentioned before, as kind of like pre-revolutionary French kings. This hierarchy also translated into racial terms. To them, this was the natural order, their dominance, the natural laws of things. Black education autonomy undermined the natural order, the natural economic order, the natural power relationship. This black emancipation for them and others equated to Negro domination. In 1873, there was a major depression in America. Most people saw it. Well, I mean, it wasn't even disputed. It was because of the capitalists. Bankers, railroad, etc., etc., and it plunged the America into its greatest depression. The solution, though, at the end of the day, was to nullify the agreement that the states had made with Red Cloud on conceding the territory of the Dakota Indians that was already theirs to begin with to them. The only reason why they conceded to it was because Red Cloud had successfully defended it with Crazy Horse and others. But in them their hills was the Black Hills in this area. And large amounts of gold were known to exist. So it was time to reassess this, because, well, even though it was the white elites that had plunged the country into a depression, it was time for the white elites to solve it. And it was not going to be solved by, of course, taking it out on white elites. It was going to be solved by confiscating land of the native aboriginals. And now that the question of the Civil War had been solved concerning whether it was going to be a free state, i.e. an industrial-backed wage slave state or wage society, or based in the planter's mode of a slave economy, that was now off the table. It was going to be in the formation of the industrial class in the North, backed by the Republicans. So there was no conflict on that issue. And of course, there was no conflict on exterminating the aboriginals. And with the economic crisis that this privatized model found itself in, the necessity to expand on this land, primarily the Black Hills, once again highlighted the need for the white bullet to show its head. So black folks and red folks found themselves in a similar situation, under siege by the white gun. Which helped set up the next dynamic of genocidal murder in the region of the Dakotas as George Armstrong Custer marched into the Black Hills and found what they already knew was there. And then new proclamations were being told to the natives to get on the reservation or die. Well, in the South, black people were being told to get on or back on the plantations under our Mississippi plan of dominance, under our control, with no autonomy of your own, our black version of a reservation. or die. And from Lamar to the Democratic Party to the White League to the Ku Kluxes, the American way of life and the American experience was once again showing its barbaric head. Now, as these tactics of genocidal warfare kept expanding in the region, from Yazoo City to Clinton, Mississippi, Nicholas Lemann, the author of the book Redemption, explains the white terrorist victory in Mississippi that became known as the Mississippi Plan, and how this terrorist tactic started to repeat itself throughout the South.
There's this big climactic battle in Mississippi in 1875 over a gubernatorial and legislative election. In this campaign, in a very well-organized, concerted way, the white terrorists in Mississippi, who were called the White Line, managed to keep black people away from the polls in massive numbers by doing things like bringing cannons to polling places and killing people at Republican political rallies and so on. There was a showdown. Would the federal government send troops or wouldn't it? President Grant blinked in the end and didn't send troops. The terrorists won. That technique became known as the Mississippi Plan. The next year, 1876, the Mississippi Plan was enacted in the remaining three heavy black population Republican-controlled states, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Mississippi. And this was all kind of openly reported at the time. That is why those three states had disputed election results in 1876, and that's why the Compromise of 1877 happened, which formally abolished Reconstruction. Now, once that had all happened, the South realized, hey, we've informally taken away Negro rights, and the federal government isn't going to enforce them, so now we can take them away formally. So over the years after the end of Reconstruction, the southern states, one by one, adopted constitutions that formally, although not in so many words, abolished the rights of black people. And the Mississippi one was passed in 1890, late 1880s, early 1890s, all the Jim Crow laws were passed.
So you can see the expanding dynamics that took place. And the white gun is just as much of a crucial component of domination through the politics of elite dominance in the privatized order then as it is now. It's the gun of the imperialists that you see showing its head in Iraq, in Somalia, Congo, Afghanistan, that we've seen take place throughout South America, etc., etc., and how it merges with the body politics of its administrators. So from the white line terrorists that kept black people from the poll to the propagandistic legislative terrorists like Lamar or the neocons of today or the Pentagon or the propagandists like Condoleezza Rice for the Beast or Colin Powell, the game is still essentially the same. And the dynamics play themselves out in some of the most brutal, barbaric ways. Now here, as I mentioned, on September 1st, 1875, you had Yazoo City expanding in the killing spree. September 4th, 1875, Clinton, Mississippi. You had a massive barbecue of Republicans, primarily black people. Over 2,000 showed up. Democratic whiteliners also showed up, armed, and they started shooting up the place. Men, women, children, didn't matter. They're terrorists. Then in a typical systematic terrorist fashion, the terrorists of the event started to play out a pattern of white domination through white bullets.
Well, the violence at the Republican political rally was as nothing compared to the succeeding violence wrought by unopposed white posses rampaging through the countryside, killing Negroes they suspected of political activity or other misdeeds. And, if the suspects were not to be found, taking or destroying their valuables. One white participant, writing with the candor that comes from the events being 30 years past and punishment out of the question, described their aims. During the next few days, there was anarchy in our county. The question which presented itself then to the people of Hinds County was whether or not the Negroes under the Reconstruction laws should rule the county. The terrible ordeal through which we passed on that eventful 4th of September fired a determination in the minds of the white people to overthrow the Negro rule at any cost. Throughout the countryside for several days, the Negro leaders, some white and some black, were hunted down and killed until the Negro population, which had dominated the white people for so many years, was whipped. A white Republican described the whites' behavior less sympathetically. They moved around in the country, killing or destroying life, until it became one of the most sickening and heartrending things that I have ever witnessed in my life. B.B. Wellborn, the black Republican, said, "They just hunted the whole country clean out. Just every man they could see, they were shooting at him just the same as birds." Very early on Sunday morning, half a dozen white men arrived at the home of a Negro Republican named Square Hodge and banged on the door. Hodge's 18-year-old wife, Ann, answered. One of the men asked her whether her husband had been at Clinton and where he was now. She said she didn't know. As she later remembered it, "Then he said, 'If you don't tell, I will shoot your goddamn brains out.' They started to shoot under the house. Mother put the children under the house. She was scared and put the children under the house. They had pistols pointed under the house, and I told them that nobody was under but the children." Soon the man found Square Hodge, who was hiding under a bed, and took him away. Several days later, Ann Hodge heard that her husband had been killed and his body dumped in a swamp. One of the white men who had taken him away magnanimous, now that order had been restored, lent her a wagon to retrieve the body. The buzzards had eaten the entrails, she said, but from the body down here it was as natural as ever. His shoes were tied just as I had tied them. The skull bone was on the outside of the grave, and this arm was out slightly, and the other was off. Margaret Ann Caldwell, Senator Charles Caldwell's wife, received a similar visit at about the same time that morning, but her husband had had the foresight to have left town already. On hearing this news, one of the white men at her door told her, as she remembered it, "Tell him when I saw him, we are going to kill him if it is 2 years or 1 year or six. No difference. We are going to kill him anyhow. We have orders to kill him, and we are going to do it because he belongs to this Republican Party and sticks up for these Negroes. We are going to have the South in our own charge, and any man that sticks by the Republican Party, and he is a leader, he has got to die." Margaret Caldwell went on to describe what else happened in Clinton that morning. Before sunup, they went to a house where there was an old black man, a feeble old man named Bob Beasley, and they shot him all to pieces. And they went to Mr. Willis's and took out a man named Gamaliel Brown and shot him all to pieces. It was early in the morning. And they went out to Sam Jackson, president of the Republican Club, and they shot him all to pieces. He hadn't even time to put on his clothes. And they went out to Alfred Hastings. Alfred saw them coming, and they shot Alfred Hastings all to pieces. Another man named Ben Jackson. And then they goes out and shoots one or two further up on the Madison Road. I don't know exactly. The name of one was Lewis Russell. He was shot, and Moses Hill. They were around that morning killing people before breakfast. Later that day, she encountered a young white man she knew, one of the force that had come from Vicksburg to join the fight in Clinton, and asked him, "What did it mean, they're killing black people that day?" He answered, as she remembered it, "You all had a big dinner yesterday and paraded around with your drums and flags. That was impudence to the white people. You have no right to do it. You have got to leave these damned Negroes. Leave them and come on to our side. You have got to join the Democratic Party. We are going to kill all the Negroes. The Negro men shall not live." On the next morning, Monday, September 6th, a large white posse of 50 or 75 men came to see William Hapa, a white carpetbagger who taught Negro children in a school a few miles south of Clinton. Because white Mississippians did not think black people were capable of independent action, it was widely believed in Hinds County that the Clinton barbecue had been Hapa's idea. Hapa's wife and teenage daughter pushed the door shut and screamed, "Murder! Murder!" as loud as they could. A white man kicked the door down, came inside, and wrapped his hand around Alzina Hapa's throat and squeezed until she couldn't scream anymore. Her newborn baby lay on a bed, squalling. Hapa himself ran to the back of the house, but another white man broke off a window shutter, caught sight of him, and fired twice. Alzina Hapa asked one of the white men to send for a doctor, but he refused, and the posse rode off. At noon, a smaller delegation of several men came back to the Hapa home to make sure Hapa had died, which he had, and to search the place to see if Charles Caldwell was hiding there. Failing to find him, they rode off a short distance to a house belonging to two brothers named Stevens, Negro Republicans, made them come out of the house and stand one by one on a tree stump and shot them dead. Because nobody was ever prosecuted for the murders that followed the barbecue in Clinton, nobody made an exact accounting of the Negro dead. Most estimates were that somewhere between 30 and 50 men had been killed. Many Negro men left their homes and families and the cotton crops growing in their fields, which were just ready to be picked, and had to be picked soon or they would have no money for a year. because they quite rightly feared they would be killed. Traveling through the woods and swamps because the whites were patrolling the roads, they made their way, usually by night, to Jackson. That was the only place attainable on foot that felt safe, because it was the only place with a meaningful presence of the one institution that seemed able to offer protection to black people, the U.S. Army. By Monday, more than 500 hungry and exhausted Negroes from Hinds County had congregated in Jackson near the federal courthouse and the small army post. Senator Caldwell was the most distinguished member of the group and its natural leader. He had fled to Jackson just as hurriedly and ignominiously as anybody else. The Republican justice of the peace in Jackson moved through the rough encampment of refugees taking testimony, which a scribe wrote down in a neat hand on lined paper. At the top of every sheet was written the witness's name with colored after it. And at the bottom was an X, underneath which was inscribed the name again, and the notation, his mark.
How many village, and we are in Africa. How many village, and we are in Africa.
So you can see how typically systematic this game of brutality was, and how it played itself out. And how the white liners would note when going after individuals that we have orders to kill. So they were just the military arm, the terroristic arm of the larger body of the Democratic shield of terror. In a similar way that, well, a G.I. Joe in Iraq has orders to kill Iraqis. But he's just the arm, the terroristic, mercenary, military arm of the administrators of the order. That's the reality. Now and then. And terrorism is so deeply part of the American way of life. You know, I'm going to end up doing a show on the episode that, you know, when the South saw that it was losing the war during the Civil War times, it commissioned a terrorist by the name of Kennedy and some other Confederates to basically go to New York and, well, to burn it up. They used a chemical inflammatory device, a chemical fuel, and threw it in a number of major landmark areas, you know, hotels and, you know, things like that, in different locations through New York, and hope that it would overconsume the fire department responders and the population that would try to emerge to put it out, and then thereby engulf the whole New York and just burn it down. This would then demoralize the South, I mean the North, into thinking that, look, you know, just let the South have what they want. We're tired of fighting with these kooks. And then thereby, the South would win by this terroristic attack and de facto get what they wanted. What ended up happening was the fire was put out with the help of many citizens who came to these locations, and then it became clear, since they were all happening around the same time, that something suspicious was going on, etc., etc. They ended up tracking down Kennedy, and he was tried and hung. The information all came out and stuff. This is not like a, you know, some kind of conspiracy that they can try to deny with, different smoke and mirror games. this was a conspiracy that was just blown out into the open. And the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, was directly linked to this genocidal conspiracy attempt on the people of New York. What's fascinating is that after the Civil War, people like Ames ran into Jefferson Davis, this having a good old time. He wasn't in jail for being the president of the region that went to war against the Union. Didn't have his head chopped off. This elite didn't have to worry about a damn thing. In the same way that the planters who ran from their land right when the Civil War was ending ended up getting it back through presidential order from black people who were granted the land that they ran from with their tails between their legs. So terrorism is not quite terrorism when it's shaded in certain complexions then and now. Just ask the folks in Abu Ghraib. Now, while this filth in the 1870s over the issue of Reconstruction ended up culminating with all the terrorism that took place and was going on, the systematic terrorism of the White Line, the armed branch of the Democratic Party. It all basically ended up coming to a head in the 1876 presidential election, Tilden versus Hayes, where the corruption and the fraud of the American way of life exploded out. And, well, for black people, well,
The 1876 election was a very close election with, as I said, politics was not, a walk in the park then. There was a lot of corruption on both sides, more violence certainly on the Democratic side. The election was in dispute and a lengthy kind of deal-cutting process in Washington ensued, the result of which was the formal end of Reconstruction.
So basically, this ended the formal end of Reconstruction, where corruption is going on both sides. You have in the South, Democrats terrorizing black people to control the vote, neutralize the vote. Republicans, in their regions of control, manipulating the ballot box. Then they strike a compromise, allowing the Republican president to basically take the administrator's seat under the agreement that they would pull out the remaining federal troops from the South and then basically let the terrorists of the elite, backing the elite white class of the plantation owners, have their day in the sun. So until the formal end of Reconstruction and the compromise, quote unquote, for one political reason or another, to get a Republican president, played itself out. And in the South, well, overall, the Republicans get a president, the Democrats get the federal troops pulled out of the South, and black folks get the Abrahamic lynch rope and some more white bullets. It's the American way. Oh, and it was basically 1876, the last hurrah for the Native Aboriginals. There was one good day. They wiped George Armstrong Custer from the face of the earth with many of his 7th Cavalry. But after that, it was more white guns and white bullets for the Native Aboriginals. Now, as I went into about Hayes basically getting the presidency through the compromise, and I went into this in more detail in the slave program that I did called The American Fraud in Every Century. What's fascinating is that during this whole time, though, you see the continuous expansion of the corporations. Their power goes unchecked. And the suppression of black people's autonomy helped in the process of unfettered corporate control. The now president, Hayes, wrote in his diary that the country that was supposed to be the government of the people was supplanted by, quote, the government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation, unquote. So, the Civil War set the next stage in many ways for the new industrialized enslavement for the American population. And it has evolved into a militarized, industrialized enslavement on an international scale with this dollar and chains apparatus tied to controlling energy resources throughout the world. In its own manifest destiny construct that is similar to the expansion of the destruction of the masses of people throughout the planet in the same way that it crushed its barbaric wills through the lives of black people in the South under the planters class and their terrorist apparatus and the industrial back class forces that crushed their way through the rest of what was now to become the new Americas. Now the whole world is a giant Indian reservation. A giant global plantation. A globalized hell on planet Earth. A world where more and more people are starting to see and realize what black and red people have been through for years and years, that there is no American dream, that it's all an American nightmare. As brutal and sick as any nightmare one could imagine. By 1890, the top 11,000 families in America, through the development of the next form of privatization that took place with the disciplining of its populations north, south, and east and west, the top 11,000 families had the wealth of all the rest. The America of today is quickly moving back to that stage. Because as of today, in comparison to the labor masses, to the elite, rich, we're at 1911 date time levels. In other words, as each year goes by, the hour hand of time goes back. And now we're at the stage of income gap of the elites and the rich, where in 1911, the American population was at. And soon, under this dollar and change apparatus, if all goes accordingly, and the bankrupting of the society goes unabetted, we'll be at 1890. And soon, we'll be right back at the stage of the American plantation in all its finest. So the white liners did their job quite well in fighting for white supremacy. But blinded by their own whiteness, little did they know that the white supremacy that they were fighting for was for their masters. And now they too are getting closer and closer to being back on that plantation with their black slaves. The only consolation for them, I guess, is that they'll be on the plantation in whiteface. There's nothing that can justify the American experience. And the American experience has no right to exist. And anyone who thinks it does, well, in reality, they don't have a right to exist. Hold on a sec. Wait a minute. My home, not by choice, but by bondage, raped, enslaved, tortured to the grave. It ain't our Independence Day. My home, whose home? No, you mean my sisters and brothers' native Turtle Island people's home, the Indians. But you slaughtered them and took away their independence. You know, concentration camp, i.e. reservation camp style. So, happy 4th of July. Oh, master, give me liberty or give me death. Pat Henry is canonized as one of the best America has in its stance towards liberty and independence for its people. And they're right, because 8 months after that speech, old Pat the slaveholder Henry gave another speech calling for diligent patrols. Slave patrols, that is. In an effort to keep Virginia's slaves like his own from accepting the British offer of freedom and independence if they joined the British side in the American Revolutionary War, the so-called War for Independence. But for who? So happy 4th of July. So while Mr. Give Me Liberty was running around and quoted as saying that slavery was as repugnant to humanity as it is inconsistent with the Bible and destructiveness of liberty, unquote, well, I'm not going to get into any of that Cain and Abel, Bible and Abrahamic stuff, but if Pat truly believed that, why didn't he tell America's demented version of a pharaoh, the president, to let my people go, meaning his slaves go, something even Pat didn't allow to happen even after his own death, because he didn't give a damn about black freedom and independence. So happy 4th of July. And it is a lie, because it ain't our Independence Day. Well, maybe except for certain Negroes like Clarence Thomas, Ward Connolly, Bill Cosby. So when America gained its independence in 1776, black was still struck and stuck with slavery, a whip, and a crucifix. So much for our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as founding father. Yeah, that's what they call him, right? Father of Satan. Thomas Jefferson proclaimed. But once again, whose liberty? Not for the 175 Africans he held enslaved in deep bondage. By 1820, Liberty Thomas advocated the expansion of slavery to the Western territories. He whipped and terrorized his slaves like any other traditional American Christian values patriot. By 1822, Jefferson owned 267 slaves. But here's how the book, The American Way, and it is The American Way, tried to put a spin on this contradiction. Quote, in his Notes of the State of Virginia, published in 1887, Thomas Jefferson spoke out against owning slaves. Slavery, he said, made tyrants out of the masters and destroyed the spirits of the slaves. Although Jefferson and others who owned slaves spoke out against slavery, many people did not believe that a mixed society of equals could work, unquote. The reality is that degenerates like Thomas didn't want it to work because they didn't want to work themselves. That's what the slaves were for. And at the end of that period, Thomas and his upperclassmen slave ideology won out amongst a public that was somewhat grappling, quote unquote, with that issue at the time. So happy 4th of July. And it is a lie, because it ain't our Independence Day. Nor was it yours, Brother Dred Scott, when in 1857 you found out as a slave in a free state that your state or status was that still of a slave, as the Supreme Court of white supremacy said that, quote, a Negro had no rights a white man was bound to respect, unquote, because they were too busy bounding you up and us up in chains. Even though, and even when we tried to escape from the horrors of American slavery, we were diagnosed as having a biological disorder called draptiomania, meaning those slaves that suffered, quote unquote, from the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So being black and free was not only a traditional, biblical, societal, ethical, you know, white man's burden, an economic contradiction, but a biological one. Damn. There's your American experience. Even though some of these other invisible men believe in religious types and states, no humanity for black either. But that's another horror story of the ages. But back to the point. happy 4th of July, because it ain't our Independence Day. And if you think it is, try sleeping in one of those Mississippi goddamn churches one night. You might find more than your soul on fire. Or try living while black in a black neighborhood where drugs are intentionally relocated courtesy of Sam to destroy, imprison, and keep depriving black liberty and independence from being truly realized. Or of the astronomically high toxic waste plants that are located by design in black, Latino, and Indian communities. Where's our independence from this madness? And when, if ever, has it truly come about in America? So from the destruction of the Reconstruction period led by racist white Democrats to the Ndar and Jim Crow apartheid period, Independence Day has been a sham. Even the Civil War, where over 200,000 black soldiers fought for freedom, freedom that swines like Abe Lincoln didn't care about, and admitted as much when Lincoln said, quote, "I will say then that I am not nor have ever been in favor of bringing about in any way the social or political equality of the white and black races, that I am not nor ever have been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with the white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the black and white races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races from living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Unquote. Old Abraham also stated that if he had to free, quote-unquote, slaves to preserve the Union, he would. But if not freeing blacks was not necessary to preserving the Union, then he wouldn't. In other words, preserving the Union was more important than black freedom, black justice, black independence. Happy 4th of July. And it is a lie. And speaking of slavery, chattel slavery, not wage slavery, that we're under now, when and if ever did it completely end?
Gentlemen, as I cannot read or write, I got a friend to write this. I never went to school in my life. I worked on this man's farm all my life. I didn't get a cent for my labor until I run away. I'm 35 years old. All we Negroes got to eat was corn, bread, bacon, and a few clothes, and forced to live 10 to 12 in a room. Overseers carry sticks and whips and guns. They whip children and women and men. They would make men and women strip their clothes down and get down on their knees and sometimes tie them to a place and whip them 25 to 100 lashes at a time. You not dare ask for money or anything else. The overseers seduced any young girls they wanted, and parents could not help them. I would send my name, but I don't want to go back to this farm. I did never commit a crime.
Now that was in the Library of Congress of a black man's experience in American slavery, dated October 8th, 1823. Slavery didn't completely end in all pockets after the Civil War, especially with the destruction of the Reconstruction period, but continued up into the 1900s. So with those realities and these raggedy chains of the American presidents binding up black independence at the public auctioning blocks, the American red, white, and blue patriots sing, parade, charade around about their independence in this quicksand made of milk and honey. Yet here's what a white woman wrote to a black organization, what was really going on in the land of the free.
Last Thursday, June 1st, 1923, I was on my way to Harwell, Georgia. I had to wait over about 3.5 hours in order to make the proper connection at a very small place called Calhoun Falls, South Carolina. While sitting there, an old grandmother came up to me, and she was terribly distressed. She had a daughter in New York who had sent for her, but she had two very dear grandchildren that she was so anxious to see before leaving the place. The mother of the children is dead, and they're kept as slaves under a man by the name of John McCauley. He's white. He's located 10 miles from the little town, running a big farm. He has an overseer by the name of Peach Alexander, with one eye, who's indeed cruel. There are more than 100 Negroes in absolute slavery. They're half clothed, half fed, and have no money. If they show at any time the least resentment, they're whipped severely, very often shot, and at times killed and thrown into the river. They're well guarded at all times so that no one will know of their whereabouts. Whenever a mother or father of a family becomes too old to work, the children have to be given over and they remain there until they're too old. They're perfectly ignorant. There was a girl quite young and unmarried who became a mother. When the baby was between 4 and 5 months old, she was forced to go to the field at the dawn of the day and work till night with her baby in a box. She was so far from the baby at one time that it fell out of the box, and the ants ate little holes in the sides of its nostrils, gnawed its ears and around its mouth. This is only one case. What can be done? Please see after this matter at once, and if it is investigated, be very careful on entering the place, for it is well guarded at all times. These are true facts.
A true fact that continued into the 30s and 40s, the 1930s and 40s. A true fact of the hideously barbaric nature and conduct of this nation of people towards black, which leaves the 4th of July celebration hollow and sick and void of any true independence. Or in other words, early this morning, there was a knock upon my door. I said, early this morning, when there was a knock upon my door, I said, oh, hello, Satan. I guess it's time for me to go. Me and the devil was walking side by side. I said, me and Sam were chained side by side. He said, now get your nigga ass in that boat. We about to go for a little ride. He took me to the new world. I said, Sam said, I'm taking you to another world. And after what Sam and his disciples put us through, it would make a savage madman's stomach curl. That's why early this morning, there was a knock upon my door. I said, early this morning, when there was a knock upon my door, I said, oh, hello, Scratch. I guess it's time for me to go. Me and the devil was walking side by side. I said, me and Mr. Policeman were chained side by side. He said, now get your nigga ass in that car, because we's about to go for another ride. This has been Tracy James with a commentary. Happy 4th of July. Is that what you really and the American experience is alive. From Reconstruction to slavery to the destruction of the natives and on down the line. It ain't our damn independence. Out. Thank you. the American slave is your 4th of July. I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all others in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty an unholy license. Your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on this earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than there are of the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may. Search where you will. Roam through all the monarchs and despotisms of the old world. Travel through South America and search out every abuse. And when you have found them, lay your facts by the sides of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that we're for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy. America reigns without a rival. Frederick Douglass, 1852, July 4th speech. It's true then, it's true now. We're still under the leash of the driver man.
Driver man, he made a life, but the mammy ain't his wife. Chopping cotton, don't be slow. Better finish out your row. Keep a moving with that plow. Driver man will show you how. Get to work and root that stump. Driver man will make you jump. Better make your hammer ring. Driver man will start to swing. Ain't but two things on my mind. Driver man and quitting time.
Is that right?
It's the truth.
Slave out.